Tavis Smiley, this is KBLA Talk 1580. Our phone number 1-800-920-1580, 1-800-920-1580. Glad to have you with us in this hour. And in this hour, as we continue to celebrate Black Music Month, you're listening to the music of Prince. Love that track, Musicology. June is, of course, Black Music Month, and every day we are featuring a different artist on this program all 3 hours. And today, we called up the music of Prince because today, June 7th, would have been his 65th birthday, believe it or not. And so Prince has been featured on this program all 3 hours today. So we got a few more minutes left to get a few more tracks in between now and the top of the hour. So happy birthday to Prince, who again would have been 65 were he still with us today. And speaking of musicology, in this hour, a conversation with esteemed cultural anthropologist and ethnomusicologist Dr. Kyra D. Grant about whether Black music and its expressions are still regarded as a powerful force for empowerment and inclusion, or a perpetuation of inequality and cultural appropriation. I am delighted to welcome Dr. Kyra D. Gaunt to this program. Dr. Gaunt, how are you today?
I'm well. It's Kyra Gaunt.
Kyra Gaunt. Did I mispronounce that? Kyra Gaunt. Thank you very much.
Yeah, everybody says Grant.
No. I got the Gaunt part. I got the Kyra part wrong. I let me just say this very quickly. I because my name is Tavis, I've been called a bunch of stuff in my life, and as a result, I know what it means to get people's names correct. So I apologize for that, and we'll get it right the rest of the hour. Dr. Kyra D. Gaunt. We won't make that mistake again. So good to have you on. Thank you for your time. Let me start broadly, and we'll work our way through this hour. And I guess the broad question is, what is your take on Black music today? It's a big question, and I'm asking it unapologetically and deliberately to give you as much canvas as you need to paint, and then I'll interrogate whatever your response is to that question about Black music in late modernity.
What is Black music today? Well, as an ethnomusicologist, I study mostly contemporary culture, but it's all rooted in the past. So, you know, it's Black Music Month. And so music today is, for some, it tends to be disconnected from our past. Our oldest ancestry is a 200-year-old festival that happened in Albany, New York, called the Pinkster Fest. It was just celebrated here in my hometown where I live.
Mm-hmm.
It's not where I was raised, but the state of Black music, if you're talking about contemporary culture, that includes Beyonce and her tour, to Jay-Z, to Chloe and Halle and the Mermaids, and that's a very different reality than the celebration of the 50th anniversary of hip-hop. And
mm-hmm.
so much of hip-hop culture that doesn't reach the mainstream, and yet hip-hop culture still dominates a lot of mainstream culture, not just in the U.S., but around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very complicated terrain. Most people know about the celebrities and the stars. I study the vernacular culture and the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so my work focuses on, and has always focused on, in some ways, music between the sexes. I look at the ways in which my first book was about Black girls, hand clapping games, cheers, and double dutch, mm-hmm. and the chants that accompany them over a 50-year period from the 1950s to the early, actually, 2000s, to Nelly's Country Grammar, to show the ways in which girls are hidden tastemakers, hidden figures in Black music. And so the only thing I would add to that is that the music industry is predominantly a patriarchal and very male-oriented business,
mm-hmm.
from top to bottom. Women still, a recent study from 2012 to 2022, is that women still, women in general, still are only 2.8% of the producers of the most popular songs on the Billboard Hot 100. It moved from 2% in 2012 to 2.8% in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not the number of the more than invisible women of color who produce music or engineer music, particularly Black women who engineer, produce, make beats, really underrated, marginalized. And I wish you know, if I had a tag for it, I wish more of the girls who twerk would make beats because they know how to do that. They learn all of the textures of the music with their bodies. But you don't always make as much money doing that.
No, I get it. I hear you loud and clear. You said a great deal that I want to unpack when we come forward here. I want to come to this notion right quick here of music between the sexes. I know you're working on a new book called Played, Music as a Game of Violence Against Black Girls Online. We'll talk about that a bit, but I really want to unpack, give you a chance to unpack this notion of music between the sexes and what you mean by that. Let me ask you right quick before I go forward, though, since you raised it, this Little Mermaid controversy, I don't need to color it much more than that. Everybody's writing about it, talking about it. What's been your take on it?
I have yet to see the movie. I've been deep in writing my book, but I have been watching social media, and it's interesting. Chloe and Haley, outside of the hip-hop space, Chloe and Haley are, I think, one of the few groups of artists that have come out of the YouTube realm. They started on YouTube and were able to make themselves into quite notable stars as a result of their presence on YouTube. I think what we're seeing is what we're seeing with the Little Mermaid is not unrelated to what we're seeing around CRT in the educational space. There's just a lot of dog whistling and pushback around the presence of black bodies, black female bodies in particular. And trying to silence our voices and trying to say that, you know, it's hard enough for us to live the lives that are just ridden with post-traumatic stress from having to constantly defend ourselves. And I think Chloe and Haley do a pretty good job of trying to hang in there despite all of the negative press that continually follows these just really wonderful artists and well-raised. And, you know, they remind me a bit of, you know, Serena and Venus in that, you know, they hold themselves well in public despite all of the target practice that they suffer.
Yeah. Put beautifully, target practice that they suffer. They are suffering from a lot of target practice, and yet the movie is doing remarkably well, and people are responding to it, the controversy notwithstanding. When we come forward, Dr. Kira D. Gaunt will continue our conversation about June as Black Music Month, and as I said, I want to get to this notion of what she means by music between the sexes and a great deal more when we come forward on KBLA Talk 1580. I'm laughing as Miles plays this song. Prince, in his lifetime, only licensed one of his songs one time. And this is the song that he licensed, Little Red Corvette. And you can probably guess who he licensed it to. The Chevrolet Corporation that makes Corvettes. He licensed it one time, and he hated it. He regretted when he saw the commercial that he had signed off on letting his song be used for. He saw the commercial and he realized that it was really a bastardization of what he intended by the song. And so he regretted it. And for the rest of his career, he never, ever licensed any of his music to anybody. All kinds of artists license their music for all kinds of purposes. There's a whole lot of money to be made in licensing, especially for a national commercial like Chevrolet, like Corvette. Tons of money there. And so a lot of folk license their songs, but Prince had a bad experience. He just didn't like it. And of course, didn't need the money per se, but it's another way to put your music out there. But he licensed that one track to Corvette, to Chevrolet. He regretted it, never did it again. So anyway, every time I hear that song, I think about that story with Prince, who we're celebrating today because today is June 7th, would have been his 65th birthday, in case you've just tuned in. So all 3 hours of our program today, we're featuring the music of Prince, as we do every day. We pick a different artist every day during the month of June, Black Music Month, to celebrate them, and Prince gets the love today. Our guest in this hour is Dr. Kira D. Gaunt. As we're talking about June and Black Music Month and all things music, and black people. And before that break, she said something that kind of got my attention, said a couple of things, actually, that got my attention. I want to come back to this first. This notion, as you put it, Dr. Gaunt, of music between the sexes. Music between the sexes. Take some time and unpack that for me.
Sure. Before I do, I have to say something about Prince.
Sure.
He was such an advocate of women in the music industry. in many, many ways I won't be able to have time to go into. But if you want to know about, if you want to find somebody who supported women in the music business, it was Prince. Yeah. So that's what I'll say about that.
Let me, one second before you go there, let me add on to that. Prince, as this audience knows, was a very dear friend of mine for 27 years, and I know him well and know all the stuff that you're talking about. Well, he was, in fact, that. Let me just, a quick story. Once on my television show, I had the honor of, on radio and television in my career, I've had the honor of introducing a lot of artists to the public. I gave Kanye West, who will celebrate with music tomorrow, I gave Kanye his first national television interview, did the same thing for Logic, did the same thing for a brilliant sister named Esperanza Spalding. So I have Esperanza Spalding on my show one night, and I have her play her stand-up bass, of course. She killed it. And as soon as the show was over, I got a call from Prince, and he said, T. I said, yeah, man, how are you? He said, I'm great. He said, that sister that you had on the show tonight, Esperanza Spalding, I want to meet her. I said, okay. He said, so grab her, bring her by the house tonight, tomorrow, whenever she can come by. I want to meet her. And so I knew it was going to happen. He calls me with stuff like this all the time. I took Esperanza. I called Esperanza and said, Prince wants to meet you. She about had a heart attack. She said, you might mean the Prince? Yes, the Prince. He wants to meet you. So the next night, I took Esperanza Spalding to meet Prince at his house. And the rest, as they say, is history. Prince was going out on tour a few months later, and you can guess who opened for Prince on his tour? Esperanza Spalding. So he loved advancing women, all kinds of artists he supported. And of course, think of all the songs he's written that other that females have covered and put forth, from Sheena Easton to Chaka Khan to Sinead O'Connor, all kinds of women who he advanced in the music business. So yeah, I just wanted to kind of augment what you were saying about the ways in which he did that. That said, you were going to tell me about Music Between the Sexes.
Yeah, so Music Between the Sexes looks like Prince deciding to not use any words that are derogative about women late in his career. Mm. And Music Between the Sexes is a historical pattern that I have been studying for about 20 years. I was in grad school at University of Michigan, Go Blue, at the School of Music. And I was looking for a dissertation topic. At the time, I was thinking I would study hip-hop, not because I was in hip-hop per se. I graduated high school in Rockville, Maryland in 1979, so I knew all of the first commercial songs. But I was starting in classical music. I'm a classically trained singer. And when I was finishing some of my doctoral studies, a white professor, who is now one of my colleagues, was teaching. He taught Public Enemy and Billie Holiday and Miles, but Public Enemy, nobody was teaching Public Enemy in the classroom. But the thing that always struck me about teaching black music or African-American music is what I prefer to call it, and the diaspora in the classroom, is they don't use the body. There is no music without movement and no movement without music when it comes to black culture. Even if you can't dance, you're going to be nodding your head on the side. You may not be able to dance, but you know good dancing.
Oh, yeah. When you see it, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I'm at a conference. My asthma had surfaced again from childhood, and I needed to find a new topic, and I didn't want to leave hip-hop. And I'm at a little conference, and I hear these two 9-year-old girls playing a hand clapping game song. They were playing Slide, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2. Then they played Down Down Baby, Down Down the River, because Sweet Sweet Baby, I'll Never Let You Go, Shimmy Shimmy Cocoa Pop, Shimmy Shimmy Pow. So I was able to, from this moment, think, you know, they're sampling. Because Shimmy Shimmy Cocoa Pop is from a song by Little Anthony Imperials from Harlem, doo-wop group, from the 1950s. And there's a song by Rufus Thomas from 1962 that has a game song that begins it, and the Wedding March, which is Walking the Dog, Mary Mack, all dressed in black. So I started to see a relationship between particularly girls' musical play, their game songs, and male, emerging male artists, which is going to be extended in my next book. New artists often borrow from black girls' hand-clapping game songs because it's so prominent in the vocabulary of our communities. So I start my book with this notion when I say, when we think of the music that drives the popular culture of African Americans, our first thought is not of Double Dutch, girls bouncing between two twirling ropes, keeping time to the tic-tac under their toes, stepping out with snatches of song and dance that animate their torsos and release their tongues with laughter. Instead, what comes to mind is hip-hop, neo-soul, go-go, crunk, and R&B. Mm-hmm. The games Black girls play, hand-clapping games, songs, cheers, and Double Dutch jump rope, may not even register as a kind of popular music because the term had been chiefly reserved for commercial productions often dominated by men. Commercial popular music, however, tends to exclude or simply incorporate the communal and everyday forms of popular music that cannot be assigned individual authorship or ownership, no royalties for the songmakers of Double Dutch. Mm. So that's the premise of this observance of mine of a relationship between the sexes. It's really a relationship of music between girls and men, mm-hmm. primarily, instead of boys, you know, boys to men, it's girls to men. Mm-hmm. And I even follow that theme in the work that I write, the songs that I write, and I have a one-woman show, and I talk about the relationship between myself and my father through music. And so I've always just had it's emerged out of my research. It was always something that was brought to me by, you know, the spirits and the ancestors that brought these ideas to me, because I don't know if I would have come up with them on my own. I was always in the right place at the right time. And so a lot of the music up until I traced that pattern from 1958, including Michael Jackson's first single, which is a cover of a song by Bobby O'Day called Rockin' Robin, mm-hmm. which is in a hand clapping game song. So there's Down Down Baby is in the beginning of Nelly's in 2000, his first single as an emerging artist, which won a Grammy, called Country Grammar or Hot-ish. and so I look at those ways that they're borrowing fragments of things from each other, which is very much like what we see in early low-tech sampling. It's very much a part of the African aesthetic to borrow from eclectic sources and put them together in a heterogeneous way. Yeah. That's an ideal that runs throughout musical blackness.
Yep. Speaking of music between the sexes, I teed this up a moment ago. I want to get your take on it right quick. Watching my clock here, I got about 2.5 minutes before news, traffic, and sports. We'll do this right quick and continue on the other side with more. Say a word about music as a game of violence against black girls online. I know you're working on something in that regard.
Yeah. So we often have a naive assumption that music soothes and satisfies us, and mm-hmm. most of us love dancing, and we talk about music being a source of healing for us. But music can also be a source of reminding oneself of teen dating violence, of the intimate partner violence that is rampant. It's triple the national average, according to the CDC, among black girls. And so I look at the ways in which particularly on YouTube in the last 15 years, girls, I study a data set of twerking videos. I used to joke about it, but that demeaned people who don't understand that twerking is a culturally appropriate form of dance, mm-hmm. including whining and jook and all kinds of hip gyrating dances that you can find throughout the continent as well as throughout the diaspora of African people here in the United States. So I look at the ways in which people are reinscribing psychological shaming, name-calling, how people are reinscribing all of this in the music that we love to dance to. An example might be the song Throat Baby, which is a popular song you can find on TikTok and the internet, and made into a children's game, even though the lyrics sound like it's children content. But the song reminds you of a song that's really about a very, you know, inappropriate act for kids to be dancing to or interacting with. And so I look at some of those relationships just like I did in the previous book, looking at these dynamics that happen across spheres, across songs, across genres.
I think for me, Black Music Month, and we'll continue when we come forward after news, traffic, and sports here, but for me, June as Black Music Month is not just a month to celebrate the grand contributions of Black artists. Certainly, there is no soundtrack in this country without the voices of Black people. So we certainly want to celebrate Black music in the month of June. At the same time, there are things we ought to be interrogating about the ways in which Black music is being used or maligned or, as I said earlier, bastardized. A lot of things that we need to talk about when it comes to Black music today. And we'll continue this conversation with Dr. Kira D. Gaunt when we come forward on KBLA Talk 1580. The incomparable Prince Rogers Nelson, who would have turned 65 were he still with us. We've been featuring his music all 3 hours of our program today, and don't get much better than that one. I hate stepping on him because he sounds so good, but the show must go on. Our guest in this hour is Dr. Kira D. Gaunt, and we've been talking, as we will in a moment continue talking, about Black music. June is Black Music Month, and that's why we're featuring a different artist every day as we move in and out of these segments, sharing great artists. We started on a Monday with Sly Stone, yesterday Dizzy Gillespie, today Prince, tomorrow Kanye, next week some other stuff. So we're going to be doing some jazz and some gospel, R&B, pop, a little bit of everything as we celebrate different artists every day here during June, Black Music Month. Dr. Gaunt, I want to come back to our conversation specifically about the patriarchal nature of the music business, and that includes, of course, Black music. Your sense of whether or not we're making progress in that regard, or whether the business is still as patriarchal as it always has been?
I don't think there's not been a Me Too movement in the music industry, in my opinion. While R. Kelly has been finally confronted with all of the abuse that he has imposed on a lot of women and girls, the structures within the music industry are still predominantly run by men. Sylvia Rhone is an exception, running a major label. So you could say that right now, we, as far as hip hop is concerned, and maybe along with Beyonce's reign, there are a lot of women out there who are getting a lot of attention and a lot of notoriety, I think. When I look at the everydayness of musical Blackness, of Black music, YouTube has a Billboard chart, and when I look at it on a weekly basis, women tend to not be on that list. They don't dominate it. It reminds me of when I first got interested in this work and Queen Latifah's UNITY was out on the charts. And I thought it would be on the charts forever because it's just such a great, the songwriting is great. The rap is great. The message is great. And it was on the charts for a couple of days, maybe a week, and then gone. And that structural aspect, the structures of marginalization and oppression, remain as long as women aren't in the spaces they get to make change and speak power or speak truth to power behind, you know, in the recording studio, in the C-suite, in those spaces. So
to your point about Latifah and her that hit UNITY, I'm wondering whether or not you think in this moment, as we again celebrate Black Music Month here in June, that Black music in particular is still a powerful force for inclusion and empowerment, or has it gone the other way? Because, again, that song, UNITY, did just that. It was about inclusion, about empowerment. I get it. And that's why you liked it so much. I'm just asking if you think, writ large, whether or not our music, Black music, is still a force for inclusion and empowerment, or, again, has it gone the other way?
If we're talking about the commercial side of the music, when it intersects with social media, from YouTube to TikTok to any of these mechanisms, including the gaming industry where music dominates, Black music is not always connected to the needs and the values that we need to support our communities. As long as we're talking about identity politics and not racism, sexism, and heteropatriarchy, we can only boil it down to skin color, sex, and sex, like sex, cars, and money, sell money, sell records. That's what dominates. They're not the songs that, you know, Curtis Mayfield and the Staple Singers, and those songs are not as prominent as talking about luxury goods, conspicuous consumption, and beauty. And that's part of our story. We've always been a people who adorn ourselves, people of African descent. But it's not about luxury. You know, 60% of all African-American children live in low-income, paycheck-to-paycheck household in highly segregated communities. And they are the ones who listen and drive attention to this music. But that's not the reality they're probably going to live. And so our music, you know, if it's not the commercial realm, then there's a lot going on. You know, I'm my heart belongs to the People's Republic of Brooklyn, and there's a lot going on locally. And I know the same may be true of, you know, spots around L.A. Locally, music scenes, there's just wonderful musicians all around, but they don't get the kind of attention, even with social media, access to social media. You can just look at what I call subscriber poverty. You can look at the lack of subscribers on channels where the music is great and culturally rooted, you know, but it's just not part of the top 10. We should be given what social media promised us. We should be able to have those people have sustainable lifestyles, not just struggling all the time to make it. And so most of those artists need to travel overseas in order to, people, you can't even really make a living as a musician in New York. The very musicians who are still making music and who were the founders and elders cannot make a living by staying in New York City, which is considered, you know, the capital of entertainment.
Let me pivot, if not so gently, to the notion of cultural appropriation that I raised earlier. I got about 2 minutes here before I have to move forward. But let me just ask your take on the cultural appropriation of Black music in late modernity.
Can I pivot back to my book?
Sure, you can.
Because it's not a common conversation about appropriation. But if we looked in the intrapersonal relationships, the thing about this music between the sexes is that male artists, emerging male artists, for example, in the year of twerking in 2013, a lot of people made songs for girls to dance, to twerk to, and they made a lot of money off of that. And they target this and appropriate the game songs. Juicy J had a song called Mary Mac that came out in 2015. So they're appropriating songs by women and girls. Not, I don't like to use the word females because that's an adjective, not a noun, unless I'm saying female musicians or male musicians. They don't get the same, they get less profit from what they do because people stigmatize what they stigmatize twerking. Even the social media platforms stigmatize the dances that we do because if you look at their community guidelines for nudity and sexual conduct, you might as well tick off what it means to dance in Black culture. So there's just so many things that are preventing women from being able to be fully expressed in their performance and music without being slut-shamed, called names, and not have access to, Megan Thee Stallion is a great example of somebody who's on top of her game and for the last 2 years had to struggle with such psychological trauma that on the stand in that case, she said, I wish you had just killed me. That is just, it's untenable to me that we tolerate this.
Yeah. More to talk about when we come forward on KBLA Talk for Today with Dr. Kira D. Gaunt. I'm talking a bit more with Dr. Kira D. Gaunt on KBLA Talk for Today. I was thinking during that break, Dr. Gaunt, as we've been talking in this hour, which has been rich in a lot of ways, that when we think about June as Black Music Month, we think about the way that our music has empowered people or in this country and around the globe. We think about the hegemonic nature of Black music and its influence, again, around the world. But as I listen to you talk in this hour, it occurs to me, I hadn't quite thought about it in this way, although I'm not naive about it, that just as we celebrate Black music for being empowering to people, it also excludes people, does it not?
Yeah, it's because we seem to just have a very narrow definition of what music is, and we just think of it as entertainment or something that we use to regulate our own moods. But, you know, the industry pays a lot of money to psychologists and beat makers to figure out how to hook us to listen to certain things, because music is one of our oldest technologies. When girls are feeling themselves and feeling empowered about their bodily autonomy when they dance, the oldest technology in our human evolution, which is music, it's a form of technology, lowers our ability to feel pain. It rewards us with a sense of social bonding and intimacy. It's why we go to concerts. It's why we crave the feeling, even when we're by ourselves in our intimate bedroom musical play. And music can be self-soothing, but it also can groom girls to sing along with songs that oppress them, to turn up to their own oppression. And for the men and boys that listen to it to think that we like this. We like being called hoes. And it's all the things that's ironic to me that C. Dolores Tucker fought for back in the day. And, you know, what happened to her? Violence, death threats.
Yeah, let me ask you right quick. My time is getting tight. Let me ask you right. Well, hold on.
Yeah.
Hold that thought. When we come forward, I want to ask you right quick. In retrospect, I ain't heard the name C. Dolores Tucker in a long time. When she was at the top of her protestation about the music, I had her as a guest a couple times on BET. My TV career at least started on BET, as many of you know. And I had C. Dolores Tucker on that program a number of times. She and I became friends. We didn't always agree on everything, but I enjoyed talking to C. Dolores Tucker. Since you raised her name, I want to get you to contextualize what she was saying then and where we are now in our remaining moments with Dr. Kira D. Gaunt on KBLA Talk 1580. I got less than 5 minutes left, and now I need a whole hour because we got into a serious debate here in the studio, Dr. Gaunt, during that break. Miles, my board op, JD, my producer, and I got into a big debate about whether or not when it comes to lyrics and the power that is pregnant in Black music, there's a distinct difference between the music made me do it versus I surrendered to it. Those are not the same things, are they? Are they not? Those are two different things. Did the music make you do it, or did you surrender to it?
Well, if you're talking simply about lyrics, like lexical meaning, that's not enough when you're talking about sound as music. Sound, as I was saying, the oldest technology. This sound influences our arousal system.
Mm-hmm.
It influences teens who don't have control over their arousal system. So that framing is a false construction, because most people don't learn how to regulate their sexual arousal until later in life.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us are fumbling our way through.
And some are still struggling with
violence.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. And dating violence for all of us.
Right.
We're talking about kids online who are being exposed to this.
No, I got
stuff.
It. I take it.
So it's not the lyrics. All of the studies are done in labs about lyrics. That's not the problem. It's that sound moves me. Like, I have hearing aids, and it has a little doom, 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 ding, and I can hear it before it happens.
Yeah.
You project what you are repeatedly exposed to back onto yourself and into the world.
Oh.
So it's not like we have complete control over everything that we're exposed to, just like the air we breathe is polluted.
Fair enough.
So is the music that we listen to.
Fair enough. I got 90 seconds, not fair, but I got 90 seconds left. Tell me your take on C. Dolores Tucker and what she was saying then and where we are now, 2023.
Yeah. So, you know, there's always a little bit of respectability politics that I think got in the way back then. Had C. Dolores Tucker lived this till now, maybe she would have used the internet to draw people around the idea she had, which was that calling women bitches and whores and music that's repeatedly exposed to young children is a problem. That's the part that I still hold to from her stance. She was a powerful figure. She was the first Black Secretary of State in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Yep. She helped start the African-American Women for Reproductive Freedom out of the NAACP in 1990. Mm-hmm. She is one of the national chairs of the National Congress of Black Women. So she was an advocate for our children in their human, social, and emotional development.
Yeah.
She wasn't about trying to censor musicians, but the First Amendment is another thing,
yeah,
is always protecting speech that targets Black women.
Yeah.
It doesn't protect us.
Powerful, powerful point. Dr. Kyra D. Gaunt, that's spelled K-Y-R-A, Gaunt, G-A-U-N-T. Dr. Kyra D. Gaunt has written award-winning book called The Games Black Girls Play, Learning the Ropes from Double Dutch to Hip-Hop, referenced earlier in this conversation. And she also did a powerful TED Talk called How Black Girls Can Reclaim Their Voice in Music. Look her up, Kyra Gaunt. Dr. Gaunt, good to have you
Thank
on. All the best
so
you. Take
much.
Care of yourself. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Tavis. I appreciate it.
Good to have you on. That's our show for today. Back here tomorrow morning, Lord willing, to do it all over again, 9 a.m. to 12 noon Pacific time. Time now for the KBLA Midday Money Chain. Up next, the Millionaire's Roundtable with Lynn Richardson, followed by Ahead of the Crypto Curve with Naja Roberts. Old money, new money, either way, we got you covered. Until tomorrow, thanks for tuning in.